Tawana to bring you the special broadcast live from George Street in Toronto. I'm Charmaine Khan, here with my co-hosts Mike DeRoche and Susie Alvarez, and the volunteers from CHRY 105.5 FM and the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. During this remote broadcast, we'll be speaking with individuals from Toronto's homeless and impoverished communities about their experiences living without access to the services they need to maintain even a basic quality of life. We'll also be speaking with activists for these communities about the specific challenges necessary to federal, provincial, and local priorities if we are to truly deal with the systemic causes of poverty and homelessness. On tonight's broadcast, Mike DeRoche speaks with Gaetan Arou about the struggles in East Toronto and the shelters there. I will also be speaking with CW with her experiences in Toronto shelters. Then guest Brian DiPardo will talk about the closing of the schoolhouse shelter in Toronto and the struggles to save that shelter. Later in the show, Debbie G speaks with Susie Alvarez about homelessness from a feminist perspective. But first up, I will speak with CW. All that and more on the Toronto edition of the 2013 Homelessness Marathon on CHRY 105.5 FM. George Street in downtown Toronto. I'm joined here with CW, who is a participant in Sistering, and we'll be talking about her experience in shelters. Welcome, CW.
Hi, my name is CW. I'm a participant at Sistering's Women's Drop-In.
Awesome. So, CW, can you talk about what it's like to seek shelter in Toronto?
It's really hard because of limited bed space. It's hard to get a shelter bed and affordable housing and stuff.
And how long have you been seeking shelter in Toronto?
5 to 6 years.
So what is it like for you to try and find permanent housing in Toronto? What things have you tried to do to find housing?
Fill out housing applications, cash applications, a whole bunch of applications. It's just a matter of space and having apartments and affordable units for people on disability welfare. It's really hard to live off of that, especially with the low income.
So in 2008, the organization that you're a participant in, Sistering, put out a report on the impacts of health on homeless women. Can you talk about what your experience has been with getting good health care while trying to seek shelter?
Living in a shelter, are you talking about? Mm-hmm. It's been really hard. I'll speak in general, what I've seen and what I've been through, too, with women. Mental health gets worse and health gets worse and not having a safe place to rest your head and, you know, stuff like that. Also, being discharged all the time, especially for the shelters who are not trained to deal with mental health. A lot of the staff there, they don't know a lot of clients who come in there and they struggle with a lot of mental health. So if they do something wrong, they're quick to discharge them, not knowing what they've been through or what they've faced in the past. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And do you know of any experiences of women who might not have status in Canada? So, for example,
refugees
or immigrants or...
A lot of refugees and immigrants are afraid to get health care also because they're afraid they're going to get deported if they go look for health care or they don't have coverage for health care. A lot of women who face abuse and physical from a lot of their partners and stuff like that. It's really hard for them to get health care too because it's not covered, and also housing because they would have to get into their health situation and they're afraid they're going to get deported back to their country.
Mm-hmm. So one of the organizations that supports women is Sistering. Can you talk about what Sistering is?
Sistering is a women's only drop-in. They're open 7 days a week, Monday, 11:30 till 3 Tuesday, and Friday 9:30 till 5, sorry about that. They seal Wednesday, Thursday also 9:30 till 3, and they serve breakfast, lunch 7 days a week, and They do clothing donations. They have housing donations. They have paid chores you could do. I wouldn't say chores, just stuff you can make a little money off of, or if you want to do washroom chores, they have stuff like that. Also, resources, housing, housing support workers, mental health workers, addiction workers. Also, they just basically, they're support for women, yeah. And a lot of women come there. They serve 200 to 300 women a day. Yeah, mostly with mental health and who have struggled with abuse and violence against women and stuff like that. And just a safe environment, and staff are well equipped to deal with mental health and stuff like that. And they're very non-judgmental and stuff like that. And
I'm also wondering, as a woman who has been seeking shelter, what are some of the changes you would like to see in Toronto specifically with how we can deal with homelessness?
More supportive housing, enough money that you could pay your rent, buy your food, you know, take care of your health. A lot of women who are on the streets or in shelters, their health gets bad because they don't have a safe place to rest their head. And, you know, it's just a matter of that. And they get into trouble, or, you know, they don't want to do anything. Mm-hmm. Right.
Just one question about getting health care. What is it like for women to, you know, in terms of getting help from doctors? Is there a particular stigma, or are there services for women who need health care?
There's services for women, but it's just like family doctors. It's really hard to find, right? Because there's a huge waiting list, and a lot of women who face a lot of health problems and stuff like that, it's kind of difficult for it to get addressed. Also, when they're not in stable housing and stuff like that, right? Also, it's just overwhelming for a lot of women too, right? Mm-hmm. And it's about trusting, fleeing violence, and then not knowing who to trust, feeling afraid to talk to people. Also, they really feel afraid to open up to people too, right?
I'm just wondering about some more of your experience in sistering. What do you do specifically to support other women who need shelter?
I'm sorry, I'm not a staff there. I'm just a participant.
But even as a participant,
I would tell them about, I would give them numbers and places where they could call and go also for meals, rest their head. Yeah, give them huge support. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as for, you know, tonight is an extremely cold night in Toronto. How do you cope with seeking shelter on the winter days in Toronto?
It depends. Maybe, sometimes I would have to go to the referral center and sit on a chair and wait for a bed. Or a lot of people who are homeless rather sleep outside than go to a shelter. And they're probably out there right now as we speak. And it's a really cold night, you know? Mm-hmm.
Sorry, can you talk more about what the referral center is?
Referral center is a place where you go and they help you find a bed.
Okay.
But there's a, like, you have to go there, sign up, and then they will call around for a bed. And when there's a bed, you can go. That can range from when you go in there to 1 to 2 days, but you have the option of waiting in there to sit on a chair, which that's kind of not so well either. People can't sleep, right? So then again, it messes with their day and stuff, right? And their mental health too, because they have nowhere to sleep. And in the referral center, you can't lie down on the floor. Mm. You have to sit in a chair.
How often do you have to seek referrals to get shelter?
Well, with me, quite a bit, because it's all about being labeled and stuff like that, you know?
Labeled as?
Well, because of my past history, it's just a lot of shelters know me really well, and they pass on information and they go by what they read. They don't get to know me like that, so it's like judgment. And yeah. Mm-hmm.
So have you been turned away from shelters because of things that people say about you?
I've been turned away from shelters because of Yeah, stuff like that. Also, staff not knowing how to talk to me, or I feel if I'm being disrespected, I'm not going to back down. I'm just, you know, I treat people the way they treat me, you know? Mm-hmm. But then again, their staff, they could just discharge you just like that, right?
And where do you go when you're turned away from shelters?
I go to another one. I call around for another one. Sometimes they're really full. I would have to probably use the Gerstein Center or something like that.
Okay, sorry, can you say what the Gerstein Center is?
The Gerstein Crisis Center.
Can you talk more about what that is?
It's a crisis center. Like, when you're in crisis, you go there. You're allowed to stay there from 3 to 4, probably 5 days. It depends on your situation. And then from there, they help you get back into the shelter. So it's like a cycle. You just go around and around and around. Yeah.
Bumped around.
Did you know that under proposed laws, if the government believes your entry to Canada was irregular, you'll be jailed for a minimum of 12 months?
Know your rights. Get free legal assistance with CLASP, the Community and Legal Aid Services Program. CLASP works with the community and offers representation and assistance with criminal law, immigration law, tenants' rights, human rights, ODSB claims, and more. All York students can apply to CLASP for assistance. Call 416-736-5029 or visit osgood.yorku.ca/CLASP.
When the club won't give you bottle service,
I'm drinking Rosé.
When your energy drink runs out of power,
I'm drinking Rosé.
When you drop your $5 latte down the stairs,
I'm drinking Rosé.
Reach for the refreshing taste of Rosé Clear Water. For the taste and purity of reverse osmosis filtered water in the GTA, forget the fizzy drinks and get Rosé Clear Water delivered right to your home or business. Call 416-284-5776.
I'm drinking Rosé.
Dude, check out my new watch.
Bro, that's so gay.
What? Where?
Where's what?
Where do you see two men emotionally and sexually attracted to each other?
Pride Vibes with your host, Ram, is your weekly installment of everything queer, from sexuality to gender identity and expression. It's as much queer news, music, and talk we could stuff into 1 hour on the radio. Pride Vibes, Tuesdays at noon, right here on CHRY 105.5 FM.
This is Kieran Aluwalia. You're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM, York University Radio, the rhythm of the people.
Sorry, we got cut out there for a bit. I just want to thank CW for joining us and for being so open about your experiences in shelters. So thank you so much for joining us.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
Thanks. All right.
Sorry.
So again, this is the Toronto edition of the 2013 Homelessness Marathon on CHRY 105.5 FM. Again, this has been organized by volunteers and staff at CHRY and the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. Now I'm speaking with Brian Despardeaux.
Flying Brian, I usually go by. Thank you.
Awesome. Flying Brian.
Or just Flying.
Flying. Okay, I'll call you Flying. Mm-hmm. Flying Brian. I wanted to talk to you specifically about your experience at of the schoolhouse shelter, which has been a huge battle in Toronto this past year. Before we get to that, can you just quickly introduce yourself and how long you've been accessing shelters in Toronto?
I came here about 20 years ago. I started accessing shelters about 18 years ago, and I probably got 10 or 11 years in shelters. I stayed in every men's hostel in the city. And everyone down around these corners, you know, the mainstream media called this the armpit of the city. But some of the shelters were good. Some were very terrible. Like, hostels are evil, but they're a necessary evil. People die out in the cold. So, I mean, there were some good shelters. I mean, the Treasure House was fantastic. Broadview was very good. But they're smaller shelters. They didn't think the city didn't like them, so they closed them. They got rid of 60 Richmond, too, you know, and they keep on talking about transitional housing. I don't know where they're going to transit people to, because they don't have any idea about housing. I've been on a waiting list for 8-9 years for housing, and it's just because Veteran Affairs got me in housing because I had some Navy time. And I finally got in 7 months in the hostels. But the schoolhouse was a very special shelter to me. The schoolhouse was a place where it was working guys' shelter. It was, you didn't stay, you couldn't stay in during the day. But I mean, we paid $7 a night to stay there. And we, most of us worked at temp agencies. And we'd go down the street and we'd actually take off at 4:30 in the morning. And we go away to the temp agency, try to get out. Either you worked at Michelin Tire, or you worked forklift in a warehouse, or you threw garbage for Laidlaw. And I mean, they're tedious and very meaningless jobs sometimes, but someone's got to do it. Mm-hmm. And these agencies used to take like half our money. So I mean, we weren't making the $20 an hour. We were making $8 to $9 an hour. And well, then we come back and the one special part about it too, we could have a few beers there. It was a wet shelter.
Can you describe what you mean by a wet shelter?
Wet shelter is we were allowed up to 6 beers a night in there. And we had a barbecue out back. It was a very nice, relaxed setting. There's only 55 people in the shelter. And we all kind of had the same goals. We wanted to get out, get to work. And yes, we came home, we had a few beers. But you know what? A lot of people do that when they come home.
So last year, there was word that the shelter would close down. Can you describe why that shelter was so important?
Well, it was very important to guys because it gave them autonomy. It gave them some say in how the hostel was run. You know, like we knew if a guy didn't go into work, we could give him some food. And the city came back on us and said, well, you know what? It's not up to standards. It doesn't have wheelchair access. It doesn't have a proper dining room for enough people for 55 people to eat. But the problem was we didn't eat breakfast. We were taking bag lunches at 4:30 in the morning to go to work. And it's the same thing when we came home in the evenings. People got home at 4:30 in the evening, 5:30, 6:30, 7, 8 o'clock. So there's never a problem getting in. And we always threw stuff on the barbecue out back. It was kind of a communal way of living. And if someone didn't have anything, I'd buy some hamburger, or someone would buy me some hamburger, or pork chops, or chicken. Mm-hmm. And it, you know what? Sitting down eating and having a few beers together was a lot more better socializing than bumping into lineups at Seton House, having people butt in front of you, people just being totally ignorant, and they don't care where they're going next. These people had goals. Maybe our goals weren't as big as other people's. Maybe we weren't career people. But we were doing tasks that other people wouldn't do. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I had a lot of respect that I'd like to see another wet shelter open up again.
Mm-hmm. And during this time, there was a lot of criticism about this specific shelter allowing alcohol in. How did you respond to people who say, you know, a shelter shouldn't be a place where they allow alcohol in?
Well, you know what? We went up. We earned our money. We came home in the evening. And just like anyone else that has an apartment or a room, we should be allowed to have a few drinks. I'm not saying we're going to have excessive keg parties or anything like that, but you know what? I like to have a few beer when I come home. And you know what? I did kind of tip. I had a few drinks, too, sometimes. Mm-hmm. But you know what? When they first announced that the schoolhouse was closing and then they said it was going to open again, this is one point. This Rudy guy from Seton House, I don't know why he was involved. He doesn't even work in that shelter. But, I mean, he said, oh, we're going to let them keep their booze at night, and they can have it in the morning when they come back. Well, they got extra police on these streets right now, cracking down on people drinking in the parks and on the street, especially George Street. So all he wants to do is criminalize people more. As soon as they walk out in the morning with a half a bottle, plus they're going to work, how are they going to drink in the morning? And if they do happen to drink out there, they're going to get busted, get a ticket, and then a guy's a truck driver or a forklift operator. He needs a driver's license, too, so he has to pay those fines. You know, it's just going to criminalize more people. That's all it does. You criminalize people when they have nowhere to drink. They don't have a lot of money. They sit in the park at Allen Gardens. They sit on George Street. Because you know what? They can't afford to sit around in a bar. You know, 6 beer in a bar is going to cost you $30. Where at the store, it costs you 7 something. You know, at the beer store.
Can you give an update to what's happening now with the schoolhouse?
Well, presently the schoolhouse is open, but it's no longer a wet shelter, and it's being cut to 40 for hostel standards. They always said, too, about that, it wasn't profitable to run the schoolhouse on 55 people. And now that the city's reworked their numbers, they cut the beds from 55 to 40, and which is funny because all those beds were on the floor. It's not like Seton House where you got bunk beds that I can't go face into. I have to turn sideways to get in there. And they have no air conditioning in Seton House in the dorms. The schoolhouse did. It had a lot better living standards than Seton House did. And now they're saying, oh, it's substandard. Well, yeah, maybe because we had air conditioning and we could sleep at night because we weren't sweating and sticking and having fans blow everyone's coughing over us. Mm-hmm. It was a much better place to live.
So you mentioned before that you've stayed in a lot of shelters in Toronto, if not maybe all of them. Can you talk about what it's like to stay in a shelter in Toronto? How difficult is it to find housing here?
I got lucky. I got through Veteran Affairs Housing. It's recently moved in 7 months ago. But, you know, I stayed in shelters year in, year out. And, you know, I got sick of them so bad. Like, I mean, they are an evil, but they are necessary evil. I built shacks on the Humber River. I built shacks in Rosedale area, too. And when we were... Oh.
It's okay.
Well, some of the shelters, I've seen people get chased out, like the Good Shepherd. You're allowed to stay there 14 nights. If you're over your 14 nights, you can get in at 17, 20 nights. But everyone else that's under 14 nights or new people that are coming in, get the beds first. And this place is a very nice shelter. People want to stay there. I've seen intimidation where a guy's got 8 nights getting chased out of the place because a guy has 17 nights wants to make sure he gets in there that night. I've seen people stabbed in the chest for snoring at the Sally Ann. I've seen them stabbed in the throat for not giving another guy a cigarette. This is overcrowding. People are sick of being stuck together so close together. I seen a man just recently when I was in the Seton House in March beat to death with a fire extinguisher because the staff weren't standing in the halls. They were too busy talking about what they did last weekend, what they're doing next weekend. And they're supposed to be sitting in those halls watching, monitoring them. But no, they're going to sit in their little island because that's air conditioned. They like it in there. They don't want to be out the sweat box walking around. They could catch something too.
So with your 18 years trying to access shelters and housing, what are some of the changes you'd like to see in Toronto?
I'd like to see more shelters open because, you know what, they're too overcrowded. And this is part of the problem, even in drop-ins sometimes. The shelters have, some of the drop-ins have shrunk down so quick that there's not enough room to move. When people are on top of each other and they're facing each other day in, day out, sometimes it's nice to move to another shelter just for a change of scenery, a change of programming. Because when you're in a housing crisis here, and you know what, you're waiting 8 to 9 years, you're sitting in shelters, you think, you kind of lose sight of that. My depression got terrible. It was ridiculous. I was losing weight. I was angry all the time, and I didn't know why. And it was because I didn't have housing, because you know what, I didn't know what it was like to be sane anymore in the morning and not have to fight my way through a lineup just to get a cruddy breakfast that's cold. Mm-hmm. You know,
Well, in the last few weeks, we've actually seen a lot of organizing by OCAP because it is cold and there has been some homeless deaths in Toronto. What has your experience been trying to find housing in the wintertime in the city?
Well, I didn't find it. I actually built shacks. I tend to build shacks in the winter because the shelters are overcrowded and there's a lot of disease. And without proper ventilation, it was easier to live in a shack. And plus, down at Don River, people don't go down there in the wintertime. So we had 3 or 4 shacks together. We could keep an eye on our shacks. Every spring they got burnt, though, because you have kids wandering down or different people, and they'd set fire, kick in your doors. They steal your TV and leave a bus battery that's worth $300 and steal a $5 TV that you're running it off of, you know. And people had generators down there. We set up pretty good for winter. And it was just a break to get away from the hostels. And you know what? We'd use the other codes. Go have supper there, stay maybe a night, and then come back to our shacks. But we always kept people in our shack, one person around to keep an eye on the place. But by spring, those ones always vanished. Too much mosquitoes, too much humidity.
One of the responses by staff at City of Toronto is that the homelessness crisis isn't that bad in Toronto. What has your experience been with it?
The homeless crisis is a crisis. They keep on saying there's beds, but, like, I mean, they're phantom beds or magic beds, because when you try to get one, it's not there. And tonight they showed on the news where they show these 40 empty beds at the at 107 Gateway. Those beds are filled every night. They just showed all these empty beds, nice white sheets on the beds. Those things are full every night. You're not going to get in there. At 9 o'clock in the morning, you put your name on a list and hope someone doesn't come back that night, because it's full every night. And, I mean, they say there's beds. Okay, I'm a 55-year-old man, and there's 2 youth beds at Covenant House. That's no good to me. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, they also look at numbers, like they average numbers over the month. At the end of the month, people get money, or during the week, they usually get money. And you know what? It would drop 10, 15% because people have been living together for 28 days straight. They want to get away from each other. I worked on ships. When we were at sea for 28 days, we all ran away from each other as soon as we got off that thing. The second day back, yes, we're all best friends and together, but we needed that time away. And like any human being, you put someone on top of each other for 28 days straight, when they get the money, they're going to go to their friend's house. They're going to have a few beers. They're not going to want to come back. Because that's kind of like, it's almost like a Mardi Gras. Let me get out of here for a couple days. Because it's so monotonous. You're so worn down. You're so depressed. You got to get outside.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned you found more permanent housing through your experience in the Navy. But for those who don't have that experience, how can they move from the cycle of shelters into permanent housing? What is out there for them?
Quite frankly, they're shit out of luck because street to homes is useless. I tried with them for a couple of years. They harassed me on the street enough times. I went to their offices and harassed them. They had me arrested. But they can harass me. I had 9 cards in 1 week. They have 70 housing workers, but they have no housing stock. So what the hell are these people doing? You know, it's ridiculous. You know, they should cut their numbers by half and use 35 of their wages. 35 of those wages, they're making $20, $30 an hour. That would make a lot of housing subsidies for a month because they don't need 70 workers.
The person I was interviewing before CW talked about sort of a major barrier into shelters was the staff. So being refused shelter, being refused a place to stay because of rumors or, you know, you've had a bad experience from before. What is your impression of accessing shelters when you have, you know, staff who are paid, you know?
Oh, I've definitely dealt with that before. I blew the whistle on Seton House one time when their staff, an overcrowded shelter with no air conditioning, they were going to put a gym for staff in the schoolhouse or into the O'Neill House, which was used for a harm reduction center at the time. But the staff got busted for dealing drugs to the clients, so then they scrapped the program. And then they're going to build a gym for themselves. Now, imagine this. The city workers building a gym for themselves, not for the clients, because they're stressed out. They only have to work an 8-hour shift there. They don't have to live there 24 hours a day. And when I blew the whistle, I kind of got fingered for that.
I guess my last question is, you talked a lot about community. Are there community when you built shelters during the winter, like built your own shacks, or the community had the schoolhouse? How did you personally support each other when you're trying to seek shelter?
We backed each other up. We used to be, when I first moved to Seton House 20 years ago, I met a few guys like Frizz. We just went to his funeral this weekend. He died, and he died because of hard living on the streets. You know, he was actually into a kind of a semi-housing situation, but he was too far gone. His body was too run down, and he died. We went to his funeral yesterday. But I met a few friends, and he introduced me a few more. Like, we all had nicknames. I was Flying Brian, Wobbles. We had Hoover. We had Hoyt. We had Sluggo. We had Sportscaster. We called ourselves the Brew Crew. And we used to look out for each other in the hostel because there's like 15 of us. Some are going to Ottawa, coming back. And we always kept in touch, and we always met at Seton House, and we stayed in a place called the Snake Pit. And we could look after each other's stuff, each other's personal stuff, and we could look after each other, whether we were a drinker or not. Because you know what? No one's going to challenge 15 people in a hostel, not even the Seton House A-team. Because we could compensate in the same numbers they could compensate in. It was like, it was inmate guard mentality. And we dealt with it, and that's how we dealt with it, because we had to build our own relationships to deal with theirs.
Mm-hmm. Well, Fly and Brian, we have to wrap it up here.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. All right, next up, Susie will be taking over the mics.
And we thank you for tuning in. You're tuning into the Homeless Marathon for 2013 here in Toronto. And joining us right now, this guest, her name is Debbie, and she will be talking to us about experiencing homelessness from a woman's perspective, especially an Aboriginal woman's perspective. Debbie, thank you for joining us.
No problem. I'm glad to be here.
Would you like to talk a little bit about yourself and your experience living on the streets and experiencing homelessness?
I'm 48 years old. I've been homeless on and off for quite a few years. I've stayed in a couple shelters, but preferably I don't mind being outside. I've been on housing lists for about 8 years now, and I'm still waiting. It's like taking a long time.
On a night like tonight, which is very cold, and for those of us who don't experience homelessness, we can totally, you know, see how the elements are really, you know, taking a toll.
Yeah.
Where do you spend the time?
Sometimes I St. Michael's or Elster's Greats, and most times I've been in Allen Gardens. But sometimes friends that have places come out looking for me and stuff like that when it's really, really cold.
And we were talking outside a little bit about the shelter system, and you have not used it recently. Could you talk about your experiences accessing the service?
Well, the services are okay, I guess, but sometimes it's cleanliness. A few times I've gone in there, I ended up getting headlights and stuff like that, and it's like, I love my hair.
What are the challenges that you've observed women face when they're living on the streets or when they're accessing shelters?
It's kind of hard because it's like most times they're really full, and especially if you have a partner, like the other, there's not that many, and it's.
Okay. You just got to speak closer to the mic.
Okay, No, it's hard, especially if you have a partner. Like, my husband, like, he was in the shelter, and I'm out on the street, and he didn't like me being out there, so he'd leave there and stay out with me. But, like, I worry more about him than I do about myself, because, like, most times, like, the people that drive around will come and trying to see where I'm at and stuff, but it's still kind of hard though.
And we were talking outside about your particular experience and you being out of the prison system and then coming onto the streets and finding it really difficult to get the support that you needed in order to transition into.
Yeah, well, I did 8 years in the pen for something stupid, but that's irrelevant. But when I got out, it's like, they said they'd give me help and stuff like that, but there was no aftercare. But that's like the same thing I found with friends that are living on the street. They put them in apartments and stuff like that, but don't give them aftercare. And because they're not used to it, and like I'm not used to it, but they don't keep it up. And then they go back out, and then like a few of my friends have died. Mm-hmm.
And
it's not right.
No, it is not. In terms of accessing services like healthcare and other services, social services, what challenges or what barriers have you encountered?
I find like because I'm homeless and stuff like that, they don't treat me right. It's like, sorry.
It's okay.
It's like they treat you lower than dirt.
Take your time.
And it's like, they think because like you're not like 55 or 65 and whatever else, that you can do stuff, but some of us can't. It's not that we're not able, it's not that we don't try. It's just, it's our body functions and mentality. Well, it's not like we're all stupid or anything, but still. It's like, sometimes I think we're total idiots.
But speaking to you outside with your husband, you guys have a lot of wisdom. And a lot of wisdom that I guess comes from, you know, your life lived and your life lived together. So could you speak a little bit more about that? Which is a source of strength
and
support.
I'm 48 years old. Like, I got my grade 8 education. That's all I got. Did a couple of years of high school, a couple of years of university when I was in the pen. But most of my, I don't know. I know I'm not a stupid person because I love to read and stuff like that.
Not at all.
That's actually where I learned a lot of stuff. I
don't know. He really looks after me. He makes me do things where I don't want to do because I procrastinate.
So you find your sense of like support and your network that keeps you going, and the two of you keep you alive with your friends and.
Yeah, like I have a lot of friends. Like when they were coming here for chili.
Yes.
Yeah. Like they look after me and stuff like that, and they know I'm on the street and everything else. And it's like, even in the summertime and wintertime, like, even though I'm homeless, I'll still run around, go grab stuff for them and whatever else that they need, and get them food and everything else. But, you know, some, they still need more help, though, mm-hmm. You know.
What do you think are the most critical issues that need to be addressed right now? What are where do changes need to happen in order to actually help
they
people?
They need to make more shelters, more beds and everything else. Not anything that looks like a sardine can, you know. Like, they have to learn to understand. Like, I know they mean well, but they have to realize too, like a lot of people that they're talking to are older than they are. Mm-hmm. So they're not really going to trust them. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to, like, even if you have to, like, go out on the street and stuff like that, talk to them and just walk around with them and understand what they're going through and see what they're going through.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because the younger people have never been where they've been at and stuff, and then you're trying to tell them what to do and how to do it and whatever, and it's like, they're not going to listen to you that way. Mm-hmm. You have to see what they go through. Like, even if you just walk around at night, see where they sleep, whatever, spend a couple of hours with them, and then leave, go home, and then come back and see how they are the next day. Like, it's not like they're asking for a lot. They aren't. Yeah. They're content with just having a warm, comfortable place to sleep, a little bit of food, most of them, booze, you know?
Charmaine was talking earlier about spaces that allow people who are living with addiction to live a life that it's not on the streets and not at risk. And you live with addiction. Can you talk a little bit about your personal experience? Uh-huh. And what you feel will be something that will help you or will be an ideal?
Well, I'm a chronic alcoholic. I used to smoke crack. I still do the odd time. But it's like, with me, I've been trying to cut myself down on my own because I'm not really ready to get that help yet. But I know it's going to happen soon because I'm almost at that point. But see, a lot of people just, especially when they're on the street, because that's the only thing they got. That's, like with me, the only reason sometimes I drink, because I have anxiety attacks and it cuts it down. So that way I can deal with people, because I'm really not a people person, but I can't speak for everybody else. But that's just a routine of life. Mm-hmm. But it, I don't know, it's just like, I find like, okay, with me, people are younger than I am, but they don't understand where I'm coming from because they've never been there. You know, if they had videos or something like that showing people what goes on and stuff, that might help. Or at least talk to more people that are on the street and, you know, get their life history, the whole scenario. Maybe that might help, but I'm not sure.
What kind of help and support have you received or have you been able to access throughout your lives, life living on the streets?
Well, before I wasn't really ready, but now I have a lot of support now, like from Street Health, another woman, Natalie, Seton House, even though it's for guys, All Saints Church. But because I come to that point in my life where I want change, but
not that drastic. I have to take steps at a time because I can't put everything on my plate all at once, mm-hmm. or else it'll just really pull me back to where I was before.
Mm-hmm. With recent cuts and limitations on funding, have you noticed a decrease in the services that are available to people living on the streets?
Yeah, because I'm on the street, but I only get street allowance, but because I drink and stuff like that, but I don't drink as much as I used to, but it still doesn't last. Like, it's only like $2.25. Like, what's that going to do? Because they don't realize, like, most of the people that have street allowance and stuff like that, they all, majority of them have addictions. So that's where it's going to go. I know there's places in Toronto and stuff like that where you can go eat and stuff, but it's up to them to get up. But they still need help.
So we have one more minute to wrap up, and I just wanted to allow you to say what you wanted to say, anything you wanted to communicate to the audience who's listening to the show about you, your life, your struggles, the struggles of people who live on the streets. Like,
I don't
yourself.
Know. I think there should be, with all these abandoned buildings, at least, you know something, everybody looks so for other countries. I'm not saying that's not bad, but look in your own backyard. Look after your own. Help people. Help build shelters and stuff like that for them, instead of having them dying in the street.
Well, thank you so much, Debbie, for joining us and for sharing your story and your words. We will be going on to a musical break, and we'll be right back with more Homeless Marathon from Toronto. And coming up is going to be Mike DeRoche and Gitang Haru.
Student Connections at York University is offering free tutoring for high school students. All area high school students, including those attending Downsview, CW Jeffries, and Westview, are welcome. Located at the Student Center in room 307 at York University. Join us on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 4 to 7 p.m. Get help from university students in math, science, or English. Dinner will be provided. For more info, call 416-986-0312 or email studentconnections416@gmail.com.
The year was 1914.
It is glorious, this history of ours.
The thing that we are challenged to do is to keep this movement moving.
I am the blues man. I'm Eddie Walsh.
CHRY 105.5 FM presents Moments in African Heritage. A spotlight on the people and events that make up African heritage and liberation.
Dr. Afua Cooper is a respected scholar, historian, author, and poet. She earned her PhD at U of T in historical studies focusing on North America, Africa, the Islamic world, women's studies, and diasporas. Now one of Canada's premier experts and chroniclers of the country's black past, Dr. Cooper has done groundbreaking work on the enslavement of African people in the U.S. and Canada. Dr. Cooper's efforts have made her a top authority in her areas of study, which resulted in the publishing of her book, The Hanging of Angélique, The Untold Story of Slavery in Canada and the Burning of Old Montréal. Angélique has become a national bestseller and was nominated for the Governor General's Award. Dr. Cooper sits as the James Robinson Johnston Chair in Black Canadian Studies at Dalhousie University. Her recent research has focused on the global immigration into Canada during the past 50 years. Aside from her socialistic work, she is also a well-known poet, with 5 published works under her belt. Quoting Torontonian literary critic Neil Armstrong, poet Afua Cooper draws from her wide knowledge of history, personal and monumental, to invoke the ancestors, vistas of her childhood, memories of her family, and powerful passions in this new book of poetry, Copper Woman.
Stay tuned to CHRY throughout February for more spotlights like this one. African Canadian history comes alive on CHRY 105.5 FM. Listen, discuss, celebrate.
Whether you love the standards or whether you like discovering today's jazz innovators, some experiences in jazz have something for the jazz lover deep inside you.
Think twice, it's all right.
Each and every Friday night, Rob Fogle brings you the music and the stories from the jazz world. Finish your week with great jazz radio Friday nights from 9 p.m. to midnight, right here on CHRY 105.5 FM. You're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM. Broadcasting at 158 watts at 105.5 FM. On the World Wide Web at CHRY.FM. And on the Rogers Digital Network, channel 945.
Welcome back to the 2013 Homeless Marathon. You are tuned in Toronto to the Toronto Hour on CHRY 105.5 and coast to coast. Hopefully, with all the affiliates broadcasting the marathon this year, I want to give a big thanks to all the volunteers from CHRY and from OCAP that put this together, and also all the affiliates and hosts and volunteers coast to coast, and especially big shout out to CKUT Montreal for their leadership in the marathon every year. And we are broadcasting from the downtown East End of Toronto this evening, right beside Seton House, one of Toronto's largest men's hostels. And I'm joined by Gaetan Héroux. And Gaetan has been working, organizing, agitating, and more recently researching this neighborhood of Toronto for many, many years, shall we say. And Gaetan, welcome to the Homeless Marathon.
Yeah, hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Good. Gaetan, I think it would be good if we could start by giving just a little bit of history about this neighborhood. I know you've been involved in working here for many years, and also you've been doing a little research. So yeah. I want you to take us back as far back as you want to go. Okay. And just give us a little bit of an idea of where we are right now.
Well, I'll just give you a bit of an idea of where we are right now, how things got here. But I also want to focus a bit on the struggles that occurred in this neighborhood over a long period of time. The first thing I want to say is that a whole infrastructure that exists here today was set up. It took over 100 years, 150 years to set up. So, for instance, Toronto's first poorhouse, the House of Industry, was just south of here. It was the very first poorhouse in Toronto to be established. And through a period, you know, through a whole bunch of for a whole bunch of reasons, eventually all the services were, this infrastructure was set up, what we see today. Throughout, since the poorhouse was established, there have been people organizing around conditions around the poorhouse. So they had to break stone to get their shelter and relief and food. So men organized against the work tests or the breaking stones. In the 1930s, there was huge organizing in this area. It had all the hostels were located in this area, all the soup kitchens, a lot of them in East Downtown Toronto. And I just want to read a quote from here that's relevant because we're going to move to what's happening today. This was a group of ex-servicemen who were staying in the Crawford shelter in the city, who were organizing around the food that was being handed out in the shelter and around the overcrowding that was there. And they signed a petition, and then they went to City Hall. And the following discussion is a discussion between those unemployed, those ex-soldiers. There were many, many ex-soldiers who were filling these shelters during the Great Depression. And this is the discussion that happened between the ex-soldiers, the unemployed, and the Commissioner of Welfare. His name was Laver. So this will be very quick, but I'll get you a sense of what was happening back then. So the unemployed, they said, these men complain of poor meals and overcrowding. The commissioner, perhaps you don't realize that we have to handle these men so that they won't want to come back. You mean you don't want to make a sort of home for them? The commissioner, that's it. We don't want to make it too comfortable for them. What about getting two meals instead of three? We're following usual policy, three meals in the winter and two in the summer. And what about the treatment in general? The commissioner, I'm satisfied that the conditions are all right. The unemployed, they say they're crowded 42 a room. These are large rooms, as large as school rooms. I don't think that this is much. And then it goes on, these men sign send a petition, and then it goes on to say, we can't make this as comfortable. So the message that the commissioner was saying to these men is we're not here to give you shelter and to make you comfortable. As a matter of fact, we want to make this as uncomfortable as we can so that you leave the city. And I think the issues of overcrowding meals are issues that we, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, have been fighting for over the last 20 years.
Yeah. It seems like the only things that have really changed are that the politicians are maybe not so open about their motivations and their attitudes.
Exactly. If you look at the material way back then, the prejudice is much, much more open. Today, it's they're a bit more sophisticated in terms of what they have to say. Yeah.
So why don't we fast forward several decades and talk about some of the attitudes that actually were in fact quite blatant that came about in the 90s here in Ontario that affected Toronto and this neighborhood very, very specifically from Mike Harris's provincial government, what you saw, because you were here organizing throughout that period.
During the Harris years, the moment that the Harris came into power, the first thing they did is they cut welfare by 21.6%. Immediately, this had a devastating effect on the people who lived in this neighborhood. You have to understand, this has the largest concentration of shelters in the country. There are huge housing projects, Regent Park just to the east of here, St. James Town, a lot of infrastructures here. So people suffered. By the first month after the cuts, Seton House was having to put men on the floor on mats, and we were seeing overcrowding everywhere. What happened is at the beginning of the year 1996, three men froze to death on the streets. There was a huge outcry, and the city was forced to open the Moss Park Armies for about 2 to 3 weeks. And this just kept going on and on. Throughout that period, OCAP organized around these issues. We took over empty buildings, opened up squats. We came to the shelter. We actually demanded that they address the housing. We demanded more shelters. So there was huge battles that happened. So there was around shelters. There's also the problem that in terms of the gentrification of the neighborhoods. Not only were poor people experiencing not enough money, but also we were the neighborhood is being gentrified at the same time, putting a lot of pressure. So at the same time as people were losing their money, couldn't find a place. The shelters are overcrowded. Lots of violence. We estimate that somewhere between 1,000 people died between 1995 to 2005 on these streets. At the same time, the neighborhood is being gentrified. So we're having a situation where rooming houses, over a long period of time, are being shut down. If you look at the bars that are also being shut down, there are rooms. Just recently at Dundas in Ontario, there was 18 men that were evicted from those rooms. So historically, men and women were able to come to this neighborhood, try and find a cheap place, and leave the house and find. Now it's impossible for people to find a place in here. So people are being displaced. And what happened is when Miller came into power in the city, the Streets to Homes project was introduced. And as a result of that, the whole focus, the whole philosophy of the city changed. So the whole emphasis on access to emergency services like shelter, food, the city's trying to eliminate a lot of those services. So one of the first things they did is they stopped the Anishinaabe van, street patrol van, couldn't feed food to people anymore, all that kind of stuff. So we organized around all those kinds of issues, and right now there's a huge, huge battle going on around the fact that we have overcrowding in the shelters.
Yeah.
The city's refusing to acknowledge this, and we just had a big demonstration on Friday where 40 people got arrested for trespass. We're playing another big demonstration at Metro Hall, which is a place that was open during the Harris years because of the crisis. Yeah.
So we started off the conversation in the 30s. We talked about the 90s, and we've talked a little bit about now. It seems like there was a lot of commonality between all those eras in terms of what the rich and powerful were trying to bring down onto poor communities. The other thing that strikes me as being the same is the fact that there was always resistance and always organizing against it.
Well,
you just commented just briefly, but I know we don't have a whole lot of time left in the hour, but if you could just comment a little bit about some of the struggles that are going on right now and where OCAP and other groups are putting their energy in terms of the fight right now.
Well, historically, we can go back with this neighborhood has always had a place of resistance, and I think part of OCAP's work is a long tradition of moving along, knowing that history and actually being part of that history. So for instance, when parks like Allen Gardens, were being attacked, OCAP took over the park and we set up a safe park. There was in 2000 in Queen's Park, the Queen's Park riot, 1,500 people organized. They came out of this neighborhood. So if we walk down the streets, and actually the two people that you talked to earlier, or three people actually, all of them have attended some of these demonstrations. So there's a strong tradition in this neighborhood that OCAP has that builds on the past that says that we have a right to housing, we have a right to enough money. Shelters are not the answer, but until we get the housing and we get the money, we have to have a situation where people at least get their basic. Yeah,
absolutely. Gaetan, we just have a couple minutes left. I just want to make sure we also just comment briefly. I know that there's another policy coming down from the provincial government that's going to need to be challenged right now regarding a change in the Ontario Works regulations regarding personal need allowance for people that are in the shelters, which is the welfare money that people can access when they're living in a shelters. And there's now talk that that's going to be stripped away from people as well.
Well, yeah, it's a bit iffy how they're going to do it. They've shifted the personal needs allowance from the shelters used to hand it out, now the welfare would hand out. The biggest issue right now with the province is that they've put a cap on the amount of money that they'll give cities for shelters, which means that if the number of people increases that need shelter, the city is going to have to flip the bill, the whole bill for that. And that means, and this is what we're facing right now.
Right.
We're facing politicians who don't want to pay, because they know if they open up another shelter, they have to pay the full cost. And that's the fight that we're having right now with the city.
Okay. So just as we sort of wrap up, I know that it was last week that OCAP opened a temporary shelter at City Hall in front of the mayor's office, which was evicted. You made reference to the trespass arrests. And then today at City Council, there was a motion defeated by Council to even have a debate on this issue. I know that there's not a lot of details. I know we have listeners coast to coast, but for those that are listening in Toronto, I think March 7th is the day to mark down if they want to come out and support the rest of the struggle. From what I understand, it's going to be March 7th that Brian's giving me the yes, March 7th that OCAP's going to be attempting to take over Metro Hall. So to open up a shelter there. So if people want to get in touch with OCAP at www.ocap.ca to get more information about that action on March the 7th next week or the week after, that would be awesome. And I think we're coming down to the end, so I'm just going to say thank you very much, Gaetan, for coming in tonight. Thank you to all of the other guests. It was wonderful to have everyone. That wraps up the Toronto edition of the 2013 Homelessness Marathon. Big thanks to Debbie G, to Brian, and to CW, as well as to Daniela, Charmaine, and sorry I didn't catch everybody's names, but all the volunteers from CHRY, to Mark and everyone at 311 George Street for helping us set this up. The 2013 Homelessness Marathon will be continuing on CILU and CJAM. I hope I'm allowed to say CJAM, not CJAM. They're broadcasting from Thunder Bay and Windsor. If you're listening on CHRY 105.5, you're going to be hearing Divergence next. Thank you very much for everyone.